Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. Today, we are discussing media coverage of the fall of Kirkuk and the triumph of fear before and after Donald Trump. The oil-rich city of Kirkuk has been taken over by Iraqi forces and Iranian-backed militias. And joining us with the latest is Martin Chulov, an award-winning journalist who covers the Middle East for The Guardian. Martin has reported from the region since 2005. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show. And later in the show, we'll discuss Sasha Abramski's new book, Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. Sasha argues that the U.S. is facing an epidemic of irrational fear about everything from immigration and health care to diseases and gun control. How do the media contribute to this fear? Sasha Abramski is a journalist and lecturer at UC Davis, and Sasha joins us in studio. Hi, Sasha. Thank you for coming in.
Hey, good morning.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do, on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a journalist who did a good job this week, something that stood out. Sasha, let's start off with you. What stood out for you this week?
Well, I wish I could remember the name of the journalist, but one article that, or a couple articles that really got me were both in the New York Times, and one of them was on the 50th anniversary of Che Guevara's death. And it was a really good historical overview of who Che was and the circumstances surrounding the last months of his life. And it just covered a lot of ground. And the second article was on a human rights museum in Santiago in Chile. Mm. And it was on this new exhibit. And I'd been to that museum before. It's a lovely museum, really, really powerful. And it was on an exhibit about the U.S. administration's complicity, or more than complicity, its sort of organizational role in the Pinochet coup that overthrew Allende. Oh, wow. And again, it was just historically fascinating, which to me is the best kind of writing.
I just found one of the stories. Execution Still Haunts Village 50 Years After Che Guevara's Death. This is by Nicholas Casey.
That would be the one.
And we will also find this, the piece about the museum. That one sounds fascinating. Thank you. And we'll put those links at yourcallradio.org right after the show. Hi, Martin. What about you? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
I also saw a Che piece. It was a wonderful piece which focused on Che's son, which ran in Guardian Long Reads earlier in the week. I just thought it was a terrific pull together of a legacy, which 50 years later is both contested and also worshipped. And I just found to do it through his son was a particularly unique way.
Hmm. Great. Well, thank you for both of you for bringing this up. We will put links at yourcallradio.org. That is Martin Chulov, an award-winning journalist who covers the Middle East for The Guardian. Sasha Abramski is a journalist and lecturer at UC Davis. Martin, I know we have you on for a short time, and we're going to talk about what's happening in Kirkuk. But because there's so many tragedies happening here in the U.S. with fires and shootings and the latest scandal in D.C., what's going on behind the scenes, I'm guessing that a lot of people have not been reading about Iraq in the last couple of weeks. Can you just give us an overview, Martin? I mean, I know this is a big question because so many things are happening there, but what do we need to know overall about what is going on the ground in Iraq today?
So there's very much a tussle for who gets to call the shots in the north of Iraq. And that is centered around the city of Kirkuk, which has always been contested throughout the ages between Kurds, Arabs, and Turkmen, all of whom take a strong population base within this city. Now, in late September, the Kurds of northern Iraq made a decision to hold a referendum on independence, which was supposed to be non-binding, indicative, more or less a glorified opinion poll. However, the champion of the referendum, Masoud Barzani, included Kirkuk within the areas which would where votes would be cast. That was viewed by Baghdad as an effective annexation of Kirkuk itself, and Baghdad decided, well, this has to be sorted out multilaterally. It can't just be a unilateral decision like that. So they sent military forces to the north to take Kirkuk back off the Kurds. When they did that, the Kurdish position, there were two rival power bases in northern Kurdistan, and the one in Erbil and one in Sulaymaniyah, and they've been rival tribes for a long time. The second in Sulaymaniyah split, allied with Iranian-backed militias, withdrew from their positions in Kirkuk, and the city fell in less than 24 hours. Subsequent to that, we've seen all land that the Kurds have held since 2014 in the post-ISIS area lost without a fight, and the Iraqis are now pushing forward to take positions that they held in 2003. So to sum that up, it's been a terrible week for the Kurds. It's been a strong week for an insurgent, emboldened Iraqi government, flush from victories over ISIS elsewhere in the country. And the Americans have been forced to sit it out as two allies, the Kurds and the central government itself, fight it out.
You mentioned an insurgent, emboldened Iraqi government. Can you elaborate on that? What is the state of the Iraqi government today? What do we need to know about it?
Yeah, I said resurgent as opposed to insurgent. Resurgent is the war on ISIS has effectively been won in Iraq. The Iraqi government or the Iraqi forces fled en masse way back in mid 2014, and that's how we got to the situation that we ended up in with Tikrit, Fallujah, Mosul, and almost Kirkuk and Baghdad themselves being under severe threat from this rampaging terrorist group. Now, 3 years later, the Iraqi army have fought back with the strong support of allied Shia militias directed by Iran, but nonetheless, they are entitled to claim the victory in Mosul in particular as a nation-building moment. So the Iraqis are saying, well, you know, we're back. We are going to assert our authority. We are not going to allow an annexation of one of our most important cities, this ethnically diverse, oil-rich city of Kirkuk. We are going to establish our control right across the country. So for them, this is a good news story. For the Kurds, who have ambitions of their own, this has been a strategic disaster.
How did they manage to take the city so quickly?
So the split between the two power bases in the Kurdish north has been profound over decades. The referendum was held on September 25th. It was a 93% support among those who turned up to vote. But it would appear that Sulaymaniyah, which is run by the Talabani clan, Erbil is run by the Barzani clan, Sulaymaniyah basically sat it out. They stayed home. Their positions, their Peshmerga positions, were in the south of Kirkuk. The Iraqis and the Shias were approaching from the south towards those very same southern positions. There'd been a deal done in the days prior with an Iranian general to abandon those positions without a fight. That's what happened. And once that happened, the remaining Peshmerga, elsewhere in Kirkuk, couldn't defend it, and they also fled.
How are the people in Kirkuk reacting to this?
Well, it depends where you look. In the Arab South, there seems to be quite some happiness with this. It just seems to be a new sheriff's in town, and they're getting on business as usual. In the center of the city, it's a little more tense, so that's where the Turkmens basically are. In the north of Kirkuk, which is overwhelmingly Kurdish, there's been quite a large exodus with Kurds of those districts fleeing further north to Erbil, and those who have stayed behind basically bunkered down in their homes, some panic buying of oil at local gas stations, and basically a fair bit of fear and loathing there.
What about the United States' role? You mentioned this briefly earlier, Martin. You have a piece on this. U.S. military rushes to defuse looming crisis in Kirkuk. And your piece starts by saying that U.S. military commanders are scrambling to stop a conflict escalating between two forces they arm and train after the army seized Kirkuk. Can you talk about the U.S. role here?
Well, their diplomacy has been pretty ineffective. It's fair to say that the U.S. did not back the Kurdish referendum, and they were vehement in their opposition to it. They did say to Masoud Barzani, the de facto president of the Kurdish North, that they didn't think it was a good idea to hold that poll, that it could have clear consequences not just within Iraq itself, but to the borders elsewhere in the region. So they were very strong in saying we're not for this. And when the interesting thing, though, is when the Iraqi forces and the Shia started to stalk them, the Americans were saying publicly, well, we don't see anything. There's nothing happening here, guys. Look the other way. Now, it was very clear there was. There were 9,000 troops on the move. There were tanks. There were mortar positions, rockets, all of these things. And the American public affairs officers were literally saying, there's nothing to worry about. This is all routine. And even when clashes started, and they didn't last long, but the Americans were keen to play this down as a misunderstanding. So there's been a lot of talk amongst American officials, certainly in Baghdad. There certainly was a lot earlier on in Erbil itself, but by and large, despite the Americans saying, you know, we want to defuse this, solutions are pretty much outside of their control. The the way that this was brought to an end was through the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani, who formed an alliance with the PUK faction of the Kurdish North, and that led to half the Peshmerga forces defending Kirkuk going back home without firing a shot.
Martin, you've been covering this region for The Guardian since 2005. How has the Trump administration changed what is happening on the ground?
So that's a very interesting issue. It's tough to be categorical about this, but what I do sense strongly in speaking to leaders, to senior officials, military officers around the region, is that all of them are saying to me and to themselves that, look, America is just like us now. It's a country run by a wannabe dictator, a tyrant who doesn't pay any heed to laws that he claims that the country represents. And to me, my sense is that there's almost been a licensing of darkest instincts around the Middle East. There's a sense of impunity which is taking root, not just in the Arab world, Turkey itself as well. And I just think that augurs poorly. People keep the refrain I hear all the time is, well, you know, Trump's just like Erdogan, or Trump's just like Sisi. They like each other. There's very little difference between them. And that really is a different dynamic. It's the first time that I can say I've felt that this year in 2017. And as you say, I've been around for 12 years, and it really is taking things in quite an unusual direction. It's a lot of people are uncomfortable with what they see.
Wow. We're in the studio here. Martin, I'm with Sasha. We're shaking our heads. Sasha, what is your response to what Martin just said?
Well, I agree with everything he said, and I think it's absolutely tragic. But if you have an American president who, over the last 80 years of diplomacy, we've come to think that America is, for better or worse, the indispensable nation, and that America is the country that, even if it doesn't live up to its ideals always, at least articulates a set of ideals around human rights, around democracy, around a liberal sense of politics, and so on. And what we're seeing now is that the President of the United States has completely dispensed with the language of human rights. He's completely dispensed with the language of democracy. He says that he's interested in what he calls transactional relationships. He openly talks about his desire to torture terrorism suspects. He talks about his desire to inflict collective punishment. Now, if you do that as a country and as a leader as powerful as America and Trump, that has a ricochet effect everywhere. And so certainly, I would agree with everything I've just heard, that you do unleash the darkest instincts. You unleash the darkest instincts of any wannabe dictator, any wannabe tyrant, any military strongman, if you befriend people like El Sisi, if you befriend people like the Philippines leader Duterte, and if by contrast you go to democracies like Germany, for example, and you berate their leadership. It sends a very, very clear message as to where America's priorities are at the moment.
Mm. Martin?
Wholeheartedly agree. Every word of that. To the extent that there has been a rules and values-based global order, this part of the world has looked towards America, rightly or wrongly, to be a global leader. Not necessarily because they see it as having any moral authority, but because they see it as the strongest beast at the watering hole. Mm-hmm. Wound up in that has been a sense of expectations that an alternative way of living, respect for basic dignities, human rights, and all of these things that the U.S. has championed throughout the past 70 years, that's been something that this part of the world has looked towards. It doesn't look there anymore. It just sees an equivalence between tyranny, dictatorship, autocracy, and what America is now projecting. And really, that has changed the dynamic.
Sasha, before I let Martin go, do you have any questions for him about his reporting there?
Well, I mean, what you were saying absolutely fascinates me. And I don't know if you've been traveling outside of the Middle East, but I wonder if you're hearing and seeing from military leaders and from political leaders elsewhere a similar dynamic, or are you saying this is sort of unique to this particular part of the world?
Yeah, well, I spend a lot of time on the road in this part of the world, and it's top down or it's bottom up, and it's often both. So I do get a reasonably broad perspective, an in-depth perspective on views at all levels of society. So I can say with quite a high degree of confidence that what I've what I've, the perspective I've just put to you is quite representative. Unfortunately, I don't get to Europe as much or to the UK. I certainly talk with colleagues and they say reasonably similar things, but you know, my area of expertise has been the Middle East for a long time, and you know, I guess that the views and the voices that I bring are fundamentally from here.
Well, Martin, thank you so much for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Martin Shulov is an award-winning journalist who covers the Middle East for The Guardian. He has been writing extensively about the fall of Kirkuk. He's reported from that region since 2005, and you can find his stories at yourcallradio.org. Sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Sasha Abramsky, a journalist, lecturer at UC Davis, the author of many books. He has written many books about poverty. He's got a new book out called Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. And Sasha argues that the U.S. is facing an epidemic of irrational fear. Sasha, before we dive into your book, well, really, it's all related. But before the show, we were just talking about how, because there are so many tragedies in the United States, the fires in the North Bay, the shootings in Las Vegas, Charlottesville, I mean, you can go on and on and on. A lot of people are having a hard time keeping up. So even those of us who do this work for a living, you'll see a headline about a car bomb, and then you'll move on to another tragedy. Can you talk about that? I mean, how is that affecting you and other colleagues?
Yeah. No, I think one of the things that's happening is that we seem, rightly or wrongly, to be besieged by more chaos and more crisis domestically in the United States than we've been used to in recent decades. You have to go back at least to the late 1960s to get a period where it feels this chaotic. And partly that's because, as you said, there have been a lot of natural disasters, boom, boom, boom. So you've had a series of hurricanes, you've had the fires and so on. Partly it's also because, as you said, we do have on a sort of somewhat regular basis now these headline-grabbing mass shootings. But a large part of it is also just because of the chaos of the Trump moment, the fact that every day we wake up and we can sort of pretty much expect either an international crisis to have been created by a tweet in the middle of the night or just a deeply offensive domestic episode to unfold. And then in addition to the persona of Trump, you have all of the actual crisis of governance. You have the collapse of regulatory systems. You have the assault on healthcare access. You have this sort of pell-mell dash towards tax cuts, which are going to just absolutely devastate poor communities because they're going to cut public services to pay for those tax cuts. So I think one of the things that does happen in that moment is the rest of the world just gets sort of shunted to one side in our consciousness. So we do. We see this sort of attack in Mogadishu, attack in Kabul. We see what's happening in Iraq that we've just been hearing about. We see the sort of unfolding chaos in various different parts of the world. And it sort of filters in and out of our consciousness. And I think what happens actually is what we're not doing is paying attention to the details. Mm-hmm. So if you talk to people, they probably couldn't tell you, most people, that there was a huge bomb attack in Mogadishu last week. But subliminally, I think those headlines are extraordinarily impactful because what we're doing is we're opening our smartphones, we're clicking onto our social media accounts, and one after another, we see bomb attacks, we see carnage, we see chaos. And even if we don't know where it's happening, we do get this sense of a world besieged, and I think it does alter the way we deal with that world.
How does it shape our views about where we should be going? Because it is really amazing when you think about it. You can open your computer to, you know, check an email, for example, and then click on one news site and get lost. This happened to me recently. This amazing long video report about rape in the Congo. I mean, it's right. Constant.
So you sort of go down the rabbit hole. So what happens is you click on one thing, and as you said, it leads you to another, to another, to another, and you find that you spend half an hour or an hour in the sort of seven circles of hell. And, you know, one of the consequences is that if you always are clicking on these stories that are designed to instill fear, you come to think the world is an extraordinarily dangerous place. And it's true. There are many, many, many dangerous aspects of modern life. For example, the proliferation of nuclear weapons and the fact that you have a deeply irresponsible leader in North Korea and a deeply irresponsible leader in the United States both threatening each other with nuclear war. That's an extraordinarily scary thing. The fact that we have these hurricanes, which probably are influenced by climate change, and we have a government denying the existence of climate change and pushing policies that will make that climate change worse, that's a bona fide scary moment. But on the other hand, we have a lot of fears that are overblown. And that's one of the things that I was just really interested in when I was reporting the book is how we calibrate risk is not necessarily tied to the actual scale of the risk. It's tied to the headlines. So if we see a lot of headlines about shark attacks, everybody my age is scared of great white sharks because we all saw the movie Jaws. So we're predisposed to think, you know, we go in the water, we're going to get bitten by a great white shark. We get very scared about going in the water. On the other hand, most of us will go without any sense of fear on a walk in the countryside. But if you actually look at the numbers, more people are going to get sick from tick bites or from mosquito bites than are ever going to get eaten by great white sharks. And you see this time and again, big events and little events, this sort of disjunct between what actually is dangerous on a big scale and what isn't so dangerous but captures more of our attention. And the interviews with people that I did in this book, it was just amazing to me how people routinely miscalculate risk.
Which one stands out for you? Give us an example.
Well, one of the ones that really stood out, I was doing a lot of reporting on how parents have changed their attitudes to children in recent years. Because, you know, when I was growing up, when you were growing up, and when most people I know were growing up, we did things like go on bike rides with our friends around the neighborhood by ourselves, or we'd go to the local park or playground by ourselves. So we'd be 8 or 9 or 10 years old, and we wouldn't have to be supervised every minute of every day. And nowadays, parents absolutely are terrified of letting their kids have even a sort of tiny amount of independence because there's this fear, my kid's going to get disappeared. Something terrible is going to happen to my children. And it's reflected in the legal system. So oftentimes, parents who do say, all right, I'm going to let my kids go to the playground by themselves, they get a knock on the door, the police have brought the kids home, and they're told, look, if you do that again, Child Protective Services is getting involved. And the sort of most bizarre set of interviews I did, I went to a very suburban school, a Montessori school, outside of Salt Lake City, a very affluent neighborhood, very safe neighborhood. And it's a Montessori school. And normally Montessori schools sort of market themselves for their education, their liberal, their creative education strategies. And this school was marketing itself for its security systems, its, you know, high-tech computer entry systems, the wall around the playground, and so on. And I talked to a number of parents about, you know, why this was so attractive to them. And they kept telling me, because I see these Facebook stories and I see these local news stories about crime and it scares me. And I said to several of them, well, look, you do know the crime data, don't you? That actually when you were growing up, the crime data was way higher. Mm-hmm. Violent crime data was way higher when you were growing up than it is today when your kids were growing up. And a number of them said to me, and they got very, very tense and very sort of scared and angry, and they said, look, we know the data. We know it. We read it. But we also watch local news, and we also click on Facebook, and we also talk with our friends, and it seems like crime is omnipresent. I had several parents saying sort of variants on that. And it was that disjunct between what they intellectually knew and what struck them in their guts because of the way they were interpreting the news. And it was changing the way they were parenting and the way they wanted their kids to be educated and the kind of independence they would or wouldn't give their children. And that helps reshape society. And so, you know, I look at that and I'm like, oh, something big is going on in our culture here.
Right. And it's not, it is the media, but it's also social media. Because now you can join a neighborhood group and find out what is happening if someone has a break-in that you would not even know about 5 years ago.
That's right. So you know exactly which neighbors have been victimized. You can go on these databases and find out exactly where everybody who's on a sexual offender registry lives, everybody who's got a criminal conviction, and so on and so forth. And so it's very easy to go down that rabbit hole and to just come to the conclusion that you are prey, that you are surrounded by predators looking to hurt you. People who do gun training, they sort of use this fear. They say, well, we want everybody to be in a permanent state of code yellow or code orange. And what they mean by that is you should always live your life in this state of besiegement. You should always be ready to go for the gun if you need to. How you create an optimistic society based out of that, I've no idea, because it strikes me it's cataclysmically depressing as a way to live.
Well, and then it comes from the very top. We were just talking about how Steve Bannon is going to give a keynote at the California Republican Convention tonight. And we were looking for some of Steve Bannon's last past quotes. In 2010, he said, quote, "Fear is a good thing. Fear is going to lead you to take action."
Yeah, I think the normalization of people like Bannon is one of the most striking moments of the Trump era. That these are guys who thrive on chaos. They thrive on the promotion of fear. As does Donald Trump. You know, it's the exact opposite of Roosevelt's line. Franklin Roosevelt, when he came into power at the height of the Great Depression, he gives this extraordinarily reassuring fireside chat radio speech. And he says the only thing to fear is fear itself. Mm-hmm. That if you can get rid of that fear, you can do anything. If you can recreate optimism, you can get all kinds of good political and cultural and economic things going on. And for Trump, optimism is dangerous, because if you're optimistic, you don't vote for a man like Trump, a man who sows division, a man who sort of pits us against them. And the same holds for Bannon. And this notion that fearmongers can be normalized, this notion that Bannon, who, you know, is at the very least a white nationalist, but quite arguably a white supremacist, somebody who believes in civilizational conflict, who believes it's inevitable that great religions and great countries clash in these huge titanic struggles. The idea that people like that can now be normalized and mainstreamed and invited as keynote speakers to state Republican Party events and so on, it's horrifying, because there's no way someone like Bannon or someone like Trump can or has any interest in trying to represent everybody. There's nothing unifying in their message. It's about pitting groups one against the other. And that fear moment, it goes a long way. I mean, it took Donald Trump to the White House. What it doesn't do, what it can never do, is build something constructive and good to replace what it's tearing down.
Sasha Abramsky is a journalist and lecturer at UC Davis. We're talking about his latest book, Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Also, tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A with Joshua Johnson. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it's our media roundtable, and we are joined by journalist Sasha Abramsky, who's out with a new book called Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. He argues that the U.S. is facing an epidemic of irrational fear about everything from immigration and health care to diseases and gun control. He says that xenophobia has become fodder for fearmongers and conspiracy theorists, and this has contributed to the rise of Donald Trump. And if you have any questions or comments for Sasha about fear and also the role that the media play when it comes to contributing to that fear, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to talk about how 24/7 media, social media, just having access to knowing what's going on in your area, how has that really affected you? You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Now, Sasha, it's easy to think that you wrote this book after Trump, but you actually started this book a few years before he declared his candidacy.
Yeah, I'd been doing a lot of work on social justice themes around homelessness and hunger and incarceration and poverty in general. And one of the things that really interested me was what happens when a society gets more and more unequal, when the various component parts of that society start fissioning away from each other. And it struck me, again, from the interviews I was doing all over the country, that as we became more unequal, we became less empathic, that it's much easier to demonize other people if you no longer share an overlap, you no longer have this sort of common experience of community, of culture, and so on and so forth. And one of the sort of collateral damage consequences of this stampede toward inequality is that we were becoming more fearful. The people with things to lose were becoming more fearful of everyone else, that we were sort of starting to think, well, they are going to take what's ours. They are going to attack us. They are going to undermine our well-being. So on the one hand, you had the sort of affluent fear. But then on the other hand, you had the fear of people who were sort of just about doing okay, but they were balancing on a tightrope and they were just terrified of falling off and terrified of one thing going wrong and their calculations getting all messed up. And those people as well are deeply, deeply fearful. They're fearful of immigrants coming in and taking their jobs. They're fearful of people claiming welfare benefits and therefore depriving them of access to benefits. They're increasingly viewing America as a zero-sum society. And that's very different from in the past. This, the sort of American optimism is built on this notion of rising tide raises all boats, that, you know, if you can get the economy humming along, everyone's going to benefit. The current moment we're in basically says that's not the case, that there's a limited amount of goods to go around, of material wealth and so on, or security, and that our security, our well-being, can only be achieved by somebody else's insecurity. And so you start seeing these extremely xenophobic movements rising up. You start seeing, you know, growing hostility to immigrants, documented or otherwise. You start seeing growing suspicions to people of a different religion. And then it ties into these culture wars as well, which have been going on for at least 50 years around feminism, around gay rights, around civil rights, and so on. And all of this starts, all of these sort of streams start feeding into this river of fear. And you see it over the last 10, 15, 20 years. And then you add into the mix the one other thing you absolutely have to add in is the psychic damage done by 911. Mm. And you just cannot overemphasize that the country suffered this horrific terrorist attack and thousands of people were killed. And we went into a national panic and a sort of psychic dislocation. It changed the way we saw the world. It changed the way we saw our place in the world. And if you put all of that together, you have the perfect storm. You have all the conditions in place for a culture that increasingly defines itself around its worst fears. And so, yes, I was, you know, reporting on this for quite a number of years prior to Donald Trump. And in some ways, I mean, Trump surprised me up to a point, but in some ways, his campaign didn't. I mean, the fact that he was able to harness racial bigotry, even though we were 50 years into the civil rights era, you know, the fact that he was able to harness Islamophobia, the fact that he was able to glom onto conspiracy theories like this idea that climate change is this hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. In some ways, none of that surprised me because all the conditions of distrust and anger and rage and fear, they were already there. They were already percolating through the culture.
What role have the media played in all of this? I mean, I think about after 9/11, the Islamophobia that we saw when Trump announced his candidacy. How many times on the radio did I hear him talk about, I hate even saying it, calling Mexicans rapists? I mean, over and over again, you hear these lines from Trump and other extremists.
I think the media plays a really important role. The first role is, you know, right for the last 25, 30 years, local news in particular has been run by this mantra, if it bleeds, it leads. And any journalist knows what that means. But essentially what that's saying is if there's an easy way to show blood and gore and destruction on the TV news, it's guaranteed to get an audience. And you don't have to provide context. You don't have to do expensive reporting. You don't have to send journalists far afield to do investigations. You can just stay right near home and show the nearest car crash or the nearest violent crime scene, and you've got an audience. And it's a very exploitative, very non-contextual form of journalism. And I think in that respect, the culture as a whole came to expect that that's what news was. And so when social media emerged, you had this sort of instant audience for the social media echo chamber around these sort of horrifying things. So there's certainly a lot of media blame for the way in which complicated news was dumbed down in recent years. But the other thing is, you're absolutely right when you say you turn on the news and for the last 2 years, all you hear is Trump, whether it was Trump, the candidate, saying these outrageous things or Trump, the president, tweeting these outrageous things. The news became addicted to the sort of horror story of Trump, the horror show. They treated it sort of as a freak show. And the problem with that is that Trump knows that all publicity is good publicity, that oxygen and attention is so important for a man like Trump. It doesn't matter if the headlines are negative or positive. It doesn't matter if the spin is negative or positive. What matters is if Trump gets up at 4 a.m, turns on his cell phone and tweets an insult to somebody, the entire world hears about it within a couple hours.
And it's over and over again on the cable shows from Fox to MSNBC and CNN, constantly, all day. What about the right-wing media? Because the Columbia Journalism Review had an incredible analysis looking at thousands of articles that were published during the media and found that the right-wing media during the election had a huge effect on the sort of mainstream, you know, Washington Post, ABC, yeah, what have you, and found that the mainstream media spent a lot more time on immigration because the we're talking hardcore Breitbart type media. We're so focused on xenophobia and immigration.
Yeah, I mean, you've got different kinds of right-wing media. Right. So you've got groups like Breitbart, which are these sort of rabble-rousing, loud, noisy sort of, you know, things. And then you've got these huge corporate networks like Sinclair and those or Fox. And those networks have, in a sense, I think, been more important than Breitbart in recent years, because what they've done is they've changed the way that news is syndicated around the country, and they've changed the expectations of the audience. Fox News in particular has dramatically changed the expectations of the audience around what news is, around objectivity, around prioritizing which stories get attention, which don't. And I think it's deeply problematic. I probably differ from some people in the media when it comes to Breitbart. I don't like Breitbart. I don't like anything about what Breitbart stands for. But I understand it more. In some ways, if you look at the history of the media, the sort of pure objectivity as a goal, which took root in the sort of second part of the 20th century and was the gold bar for, you know, 40 or 50 years in journalism, historically has been the exception. If you look at the history of journalism, journalism's always been loud, it's always been messy, it's always been political, it's always been opinionated. If you go back to the 19th century, American media was at least as loud and noisy as it is today. If you go back to the French Revolution and you look at the pamphleteers of the French Revolution, there was no pretense at objectivity. Mm. Those guys were part of what they saw as a political struggle. So I don't like Breitbart's politics. I don't like anything about it. But I understand that it's, you know, basically part of a political struggle that it's glommed onto. What disgusts me about Fox News is it's really just doing it for a dollar. Mm. Fox News has realized that there is a corporate dollar to be made from playing into this. And it's that sort of sheer opportunism of Fox and Sinclair and these other corporate right-wing media outlets. That's what absolutely disgusts me.
I'm glad you bring this up, because I have yet to hear a really good analysis about what effect Fox has really had on this country and other journalism outlets, even journalism students. Yeah. This obsession with objectivity, being fair and balanced. I mean, I hear a lot of young people asking their first question sometimes when they come to the studio, what do you think about objectivity?
Yeah.
And I just wonder, wow, where is this coming from? I mean, obviously, we can talk about this, but that's the first question.
Well, I think one of the really fascinating media developments of the last year or two has been the way in which mainstream media, like the New York Times, Washington Post, has had to rethink how they cover an outright lie, an outright fabrication. And so you used to see the news being absolutely deferential to the president. So even if the president said something that was, you know, clearly wrong or clearly a deliberate falsehood, they would give deference in the news coverage. And then maybe in the editorial, they would call the president out or whoever made the falsehood. Because Trump and his administration systematically lie, it's not that they sort of accidentally miss the truth every so often, but they systematically lie. The news coverage has had to change accordingly, mm-hmm, because this idea of objectivity, of just reporting verbatim what the president said with no context, no analysis, no truth falsehood, it doesn't work. And so now what you see in the news coverage, not in the editorial pages, but in the news coverage itself, you see headlines like "The President Lies" or "The President Falsely Says This." And it's really interesting, because does that mean that those papers are less objective than they were? I don't think so. I think what it means is that they understand that objectivity is more complicated than giving equal voice to two opinions, even when one of those voices is clearly manipulating the truth.
Today we're speaking with journalist Sasha Abramsky about his new book, Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. And we're talking about the media's role in really pushing and selling fear. And if you have any questions or comments for Sasha, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from a listener who says, while we can all agree that Trump is a, I can't use the word on the air, but I'll say jerk, and that he's ruining everything, we are urged, on the other hand, to mount resistance to him and to the, and on the other, to talk to the enemy and to understand their point of view. For example, racism, warmongering. How are we supposed to be nice to Republicans, the leadership who supports him at roughly 100%, or mount an offense against them? What are we supposed to do?
You know, I think that's a good question. And I guess the way I'd put it is, I've talked to a lot of people around the country over the last 25 years as a journalist. And sometimes people say things that I just flat out don't agree with or I know aren't true. But I do find that when you sit down and talk with people, you can have really interesting conversations across partisan lines. Doesn't mean you're always going to come to an agreement, but that kind of conversation is in and of itself helpful. You know, I go to the rural West and I talk to gun owners, and they'll talk to me about why they stockpile guns. And I don't come away thinking, gosh, I've got to go out and buy an AR-15. But I do come away thinking, all right, I understand their point of view a little bit better than before I had that conversation. So, you know, first and foremost, I think conversation is a part of the civil political process. Does that mean that we should have a conversation with absolutely everybody? No, I don't think it's particularly fruitful to email Richard Spencer, the white supremacist neo-Nazi leader, and say, hey, let's sit down, have a coffee, and discuss why you're a white supremacist. I think there are clearly sort of boundaries there. But here's what I would say. That Donald Trump got elected, and we were talking about this before the show, Donald Trump didn't get elected by half the American public. Donald Trump got elected by about 42% of the voting public. Only about half the public voted. Donald Trump actually got elected by about 20-something percent of the adult population, and of that 20-something percent, one has to assume a goodly number of those people held their nose when they cast their vote. They weren't ardent Trumpites. But they did want tax cuts or whatever some of the classic Republican positions are. And I do think that you have to be able to have a conversation with those people at the very least. Because if our democracy is going to survive, if we're going to be able to have competing political views, if we're going to be able to have sensible political discourse that doesn't degenerate into the kind of insults and inane name-calling that Trump turns politics into, we're going to have to be able to recognize that there are people of good faith, good conscience, who don't necessarily always agree with us. And we're going to have a conversation with those people. Now, you know, I'm a journalist, I write opinion pieces, and I frequently get extremely hate-filled, sometimes threatening emails from Trump supporters. And, you know, to me, that is a complete debasement of politics. You don't agree with me, that's fine. Send me a note. Let's have an intellectual conversation about why you disagree. That's fine. I like that. But don't send an email saying, because you wrote something I disagree with, you are the enemy. You're a traitor. I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to hurt your family. That's not civil discourse. And that doesn't belong in a democratic political system.
Well, thank you for writing in. If you'd like to write in or give us a call if you have a question or comment for Sasha Abramsky, he's out with a new book called Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You spoke about the breakdown of these democratic institutions a bit earlier. Can you talk more about that? Because you have written a lot about poverty and homelessness. What are your thoughts about, I mean, when you look at the data, there was a study from the OECD that looked at the elders in 35 different countries. And at the bottom of the list, you have Mexico, Chile, the United States.
Right.
Here in California, one in five or six is considered to be living in poverty, can't make ends meet. Can you talk about the role that that is playing?
Yeah, I think when you have the kinds of inequality that we're seeing now, where roughly 50 million Americans, it goes up, it goes down a little bit, but roughly 50 million Americans is economically impoverished enough that they're considered to be below the government-defined poverty line. And roughly one in six Americans is food insecure. It doesn't mean they're starving to death, but it means that they're on a daily basis anxious about where their food's coming from. And when you have people who struggle, even with the continued existence of the Affordable Care Act, when you have people who struggle to access health care or worry that they have such high copays and deductibles that if they get sick, they're still going to be bankrupted. When you have people who systematically are deprived of an opportunity to get educated properly because they live in areas where the schools are so dilapidated, when you have those kind of inequalities, it frays the fabric of community. And one of the things that happens when you fray the fabric of community is people start looking to strong men for solutions. They start thinking, all right, the democratic process is breaking down. It's not delivering the goods. Because it's all well and good to have that ideal. It's all well and good to say philosophically democracy is the best way of governing that we as human beings have ever developed. But if that ideal is seen to again and again and again fail to deliver material goods to a number of people, you do have an opening for demagogues. And that's the opening that demagogues have always seized on. There's nothing unique about Trump, I mean, apart from the fact that he uses Twitter in a particularly unique way. But as a sort of concept, this idea of a bombastic, narcissistic, power-crazed strongman, as a concept, that's as old as the hills. They've always been demagogues willing to exploit civil strife and civil conflict and civil division. And so that's what I was talking about, that if we don't get a handle on these inequalities, if we don't give a voice to people who feel they've been left voiceless by the direction of the economy, the direction of society, we do give an opening to the Donald Trumps. And it won't just be Donald Trump. It will be Donald Trump and the next demagogue and the next demagogue and the one after that. And eventually there'll be nothing left of our democratic system. So we really do have to get a handle on this thing pretty quickly.
Mm. What do you think we will see? I mean, at this point, you've got the Bannon wing, I mean, saying that John Boehner is not conservative enough, right? So when you look at the Republican Party specifically, what are your thoughts about where that party is moving?
Well, my thoughts are that you can only stretch an elastic band so far before that elastic band snaps. And at some point, moderate Republicans, of which there still are some, not a huge number necessarily, but there still are moderate Republicans in positions of power. At some point, those moderate Republicans are going to turn away from their own party in horror. And you've heard rumblings about this. John Kasich has made rumblings about this. John McCain hasn't talked about leaving the party, but he's clearly sort of decided to all intents and purposes to act as a political independent. At some point, the party breaks. Now, I thought, and I wrote about this during the election campaign, that there was a pretty good chance during the election campaign itself that that party would have split, and it didn't. It made this incredibly Faustian, you know, disgusting bargain with the devil, basically. It made this bargain that it would tolerate Trump to try and get things like tax cuts and the Supreme Court judge and federal justices and so on. But that Faustian bargain can only hold so long. And so the more that Bannon becomes mainstreamed, the more John Kasich and these other moderates are going to be sort of pushed to the breaking point.
Well, and it's interesting to me that, I mean, John Kasich as a moderate for women raises eyebrows because the man is just so incredibly anti-choice. Yeah. I mean, things have shifted so far to the right. He's embracing very extreme positions on abortion, but that's where we are today.
That's right. And, you know, if you actually look at where the Republican Party's center of gravity is on a host of issues, it's far, far to the right of any other mainstream conservative party in the Western world. So one piece of information I read recently, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was absolutely fascinating, was the number of Republican candidates who believed in evolution in 2016. Of the 17 major candidates, only one of them apparently unequivocally stated he believed in evolution. So this sort of move away from science and this move away from women's rights and this move away from civil rights and this willingness to embrace voter suppression and all these other horrendous things that we're seeing, that's now mainstream Republican orthodoxy. And then, as you said, you have the sort of rightward push from the Bannon wing of the party and the Trump wing of the party. And it's absolutely extraordinary. But that's where we stand. And that's why someone like Kasich is the moderate voice now.
Did you ever think this time last year that Steve Bannon would be giving the keynote address at tonight's California Republican Party dinner?
to be honest, it doesn't entirely surprise me, because the California Republican Party has done such a good job in the last 10 years, essentially, of rendering itself irrelevant in California. It's become an increasingly extremist, increasingly unelectable wing of politics in California. And I think, you know, it's sort of in its death throes. And a party in its death throes goes for rabble-rousers like Bannon.
We have time for one question. Ed in Berkeley, we're almost out of time, so if you can be brief, please.
Very quickly, I'd just like to ask your guest if he agrees with me. This whole Trump business and the whole what happened to the country so badly in the last several years have been the result of the bogus war and terror. He's scared people to death, and they will yield everything, their civil liberty, their assets, their freedom, and that's exactly what happened. We have a totally unfit man like Trump, shady business, bad businessman, take over the greatest country in the world. See if you agree with me.
Well, I certainly agree it's a key part of it. And if you read George Orwell's book, 1984, you had this idea of a sort of very dystopian state that created and consolidated its power around the notion of permanent war. And it didn't really matter who the enemy was. It kept shifting the enemy for political convenience. But it was the permanent state of war that was important. And I absolutely agree with you. In a permanent state of war against an amorphous enemy, and the war on terror is essentially a war against an ideology. Mm-hmm. And how you win a physical war against an abstract concept, it doesn't really make sense. So we've resorted to whack-a-mole. We've resorted to trying to kill and kill and kill and kill to try and outkill the terrorist groups before they can create more terrorists. That was how Donald Rumsfeld put it. If you do that, yes, it comes with consequences. And one of the consequences is it makes possible the sacrificing of civil liberties. It makes possible the consolidation of a national security surveillance state. And ultimately, it makes possible the rise of demagogues like Donald Trump. I certainly don't think it's the only thing responsible for Trumpism, certainly a large part.
Mm. Well, and with so much money at stake, the cynics would say, when does this cycle end? I also wanted to ask you, Sasha, do you have any hope in the resistance that you're seeing on the streets?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, the subtitle of my book is The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. If I was allowed a longer subtitle, it would probably say The Triumph of Fear and the Temporary End of the American Dream and the Birthing of a Very, Very Powerful Resistance on the Streets. And that's obviously an awful subtitle. But the point being, I do believe that the ways in which people are mobilizing and the ways in which alliances are being formed and the ways in which different groups that maybe in the past had their own focus point, whether it was immigration or women's rights or the environment or whatever it might be, that those groups are now coming together in a holistic critique of the moment, and they're looking for other narratives and they're looking for other policy approaches. And most importantly, maybe, they're looking for ways to bind people together that doesn't rely on binding people through an exploitation of fears, that creates more hopeful alternatives. So I do believe in the resistance, but I don't think it's going to be easy, and I don't think it's going to be quick.
Sasha Abramsky is a journalist, lecturer at UC Davis, and author of Jumping at Shadows, The Triumph of Fear and the End of the American Dream. You can find out more about Sasha's work and his past books and articles at yourcallradio.org. Sasha, thank you for coming in.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Nice to see you in person. Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes. Malihei Razazan produced today. Show. Lauren Schechter is our intern. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.